They're moving in fast, and so should you. Meet the pest nerds at Greenix. We study bugs, so you don't have to. Our science-backed treatments protect your home from over 50 different pests. Ants, wasps, rodents, mosquitoes, you name it. Bundle pest and rodent control and save $150. Spots are filling fast. Schedule today at greenixpc.com. That's green, I-X-P-C.com. Greenix. Pests hate us. Customers love us.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that come out this week. And listen, I know we say this every week, but this is a big week for comics. There are a lot
it
of
really
huge...
is.
It really is. Yeah. I'm not lying
it's
this time.
It's all the same to me. It's all
no,
the right
dude,
amount.
Come on, dude.
Every stack is just the right amount. No more, no less.
Hard to disagree. This week is crazy. I mean, we've got some big things happening. A lot of big swings, a lot of big events. It's very exciting.
So let's get into it. Let's not waste any more time and kick it off talking about where else DCKO.
My four favorite letters together, finally.
Wow. But not in this order. Not in this order. You spell it a different way.
I like coked. OKCD. Yeah.
Dot. I'm coked. DCKO number Alex one from DC coked. Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Javi Fernandez and Zermanico. We did a breakdown of the bracket we thought was going to be leading into DCKO that you should check out in our podcast and also on YouTube if you want to see it visually. What we did was there are 32 contenders entering a ring. We broke it all down, decided what our bracket was going to be. Oopsie daisy, I got to say right at the top here, because this first issue, we should have seen this coming, it's full of wild twists, wild swings. Huge events for the DC universe in a way bigger way, frankly, than I expected, given how that they were selling this book. But the setup is a year on from the DC All-In Special. Darkseid has now gained enough energy from conquering the absolute universe and working his way back through time to take over the main DC universe. And the DC heroes find out from a little group called the Quantum Quorum, who is a bunch of time travelers, that they've got a week before this is going to happen. So they hatch a plan. It's pretty complicated. It's very comic booky. But basically, inside of the center of the Earth is this thing called the Heart of Apocalypse. And they realize they can restart it, enter a tournament, or at least it's going to seem like a tournament to them. And at the end of that, one of them will come out with enough Omega energy to kind of be a dark side of their own. The risk there, of course,
because their only way to beat Darkseid, Darkseid wins in every Darkseid. World,
becoming.
Is to become Darkseid.
They are hopeful that since they're sending 32 heroes in there, that whoever comes out on the other side will have enough heroism left to fight their Darkseid nature and reboot the universe to stop Darkseid. The risk is that might not happen. They may have a duo of Darkseids, if you will, at the end.
There's too many Darkseids.
But that's just the beginning of the wild twists and turns of this issue, and I'm going to put a big spoiler warning, not just for this, but for everything that we're going to be talking about in the stack. Man, I thought this was great. I was floored by this, and I got to say, just from a DC publishing perspective, this is 2 weeks in a row after Absolute Evil, where I was just floored by an event comic book that they're putting out.
And it's crazy they're happening at the same time. This comic book is amazing because it's just – Scott Snyder is one of the most meticulous and thoughtful writers out there in comics. Whenever we talk to him – Alex and I talked to him about a year ago at New York Comic Con. And he's the kind of guy that's like, hey, is this good? And we're like, yes. Yes, it is. And that humility, I think, is what keeps him grounded to the story. And in this, we get to meet our heroes where they're playing a game. Just a couple of heroes gathered together playing a fun board game. And that informs the story so hard as we go from that to the most heightened version of that possible. The art by Javi Fernandez is so good. And it feels right. This is such a great Superman issue. It's such a great Batman issue. Up to a point where something intense happens that I think is exciting.
Well, what's tough about this is I'm too invested because now I have a bracket and I'm just rooting for my goddamn
bracket. Your
bracket's
busted.
I know. And that's what makes me upset is I'm reading this and then it seems like maybe Batman's dead already. And I'm like, well, there goes my fucking bracket.
It seems that way. He's definitely, if you look at the back page of the bracket, the Batman has a Joker lip smile on it.
So just to
Batman
talk down,
is Joker.
To talk down some of the big events of the issue, just so we can kind of get it out of the way. First of all, they reference the New 52 Wild, and they do that in a very meta way where they're like,
yes.
No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that this time. We're going to find another way to do it, which I thought was very fun and surprising.
Very cool.
Very cool. And basically being like, DC constantly gets made fun of for doing reboots. And they're like, we're not doing a reboot this time in the text. Then we get the tournament itself. Bunch of characters die immediately. And I'll give a little asterisk there. They're very clear that like game pieces, they're put on the shelf. We are going to see Batman again. There's a series called Night Fight that's coming out.
Oh, you think
so? There's a series called Night Fight that is spinning directly out of this where he has to fight all of the Robins from alternate universes who have grown out to be Batmen. We don't know necessarily if this is like he's in hell or exactly what's going on here. But the idea of this is like a slowed down time thing that happened. Regardless, what happens is as they're fighting their way through, they've taken all the villains off the board because they know they're going to mess this up. But somehow a bunch of them have figured their way in and Joker kills Batman. Shocking moment number two. Immediately following that, after they get the 32 contenders, and they're like, okay, we laid it out. Surprise, it's Joker instead of Batman. Then they drop, like, it's the narration is coming from the heart of Apocalypse. So he's like, I've already seen the end of this. I know it's going to, or she, or it. I know what's going to happen because Darkseid is already bringing out his Dogs of War, who we get to see in Shadow, are the Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman from the Absolute Universe. And then last little kicker is like, and none of them are going to win. And they're not going to win because Darkseid is already here and he is pretending to be somebody else. We get the hint, the very strong hint, is that it is Booster Gold, who was rescued from the Absolute Universe, is actually Darkseid in disguise. So it's just like kicking the nuts after kicking the nuts for the DC heroes of this issue.
And that's what Pete loves about comics, is repeated.
I do love that because I love the idea of being put in a place for a first issue where I thought I knew the way this event was going to go because they're like, yeah, we're just doing a fun fight thing. And immediately, even though I've been reading comic books for decades, going into this now, I'm like, well, maybe they're going to lose. Maybe they're going to lose the end. Maybe the end of five issues, it's just going to be Darkseid for the next year until they fight back.
But that's the thing is I can't enjoy this comic because I'm fucking rooting for my goddamn bracket. And if I didn't have a fucking bracket, I could just enjoy the fucking comic
book. Well, that's because your brain is broken. That's not the comic's fault.
Yeah, that's not the comic's fault. And I wish we had another bracket thing because that's no fun. Just like try to put it aside. Think about that as a separate thing
who
that
cares?
Is outside.
Forget it.
Like I had,
also, your bracket
I had
is busted.
Going. Yeah, I know.
You're
I had
busted,
Batman
so
going.
Get,
yeah, I
let
was
it
like,
go.
Oh, dude, I'm so fucked.
Well, here's the thing: Joker as Batman could still go, and your bracket would be fine because he is the Batman role in this. And honestly, it makes the Batman versus Damian fight super interesting.
Except I think there's no way not to get too deep into this. No way they're not going to end up with Joker versus Red Hood at this point. Like that absolutely.
Oh, yes. Oh, you're right. Sorry. It's Red Hood versus Damian. Yeah. I think my bracket actually is the big winner in this fight because I had Red Hood taking on Batman. Well,
yeah, you're the bracket fucking expert of the three of us. I'm shocked that your bracket is really fucking good.
I think that I'm right. That's a weird opinion I have on this podcast.
I mean, we all think we're right all the time. That's fine. Maybe me more so than you. That's also fine, I think. Friends, we're all friends. But let me say specifically, the drama of Joker as Batman fighting Red Hood in the second round is too ripe. It's too crispy to not do that. And
too
I think
crispy.
Red Hood gets the revenge that he's been waiting for.
What I'm most curious about, though, at this point is what this series is. This is a very narration-heavy issue. This almost feels like a prologue down to they're not even at the tournament yet by the time this ends. They're just entering it with a bunch of people eliminated. So, like, what is the actual form of the comic book? What is going to happen over the course of the four issues? Really curious to see. Obviously, like, on pins and needles, wondering what's going to happen with the DC Universe, and that's the place you want to be in with superhero comics. Well,
I also think that, like, I think this is a cool event, really fun idea, really well executed, but they had the trope in here, it was like, hey, we've got to hurry up and make a decision. And then they're just fucking monologuing and just talking. And it's like, we're not going to get to a decision for a while.
But here's the thing, though. I think it works really well because it's like when you read the instructions ahead of playing a game that you're all excited to
100%.
Play. It's like you get what's happening, you get the rules, and now we get to play.
You read
we
the
get to
instructions
play from here
before you start playing?
Yeah, I don't know. Have you ever, would you want to enjoy something? Do a little bit of preparation.
Yeah,
you know
I don't usually read the instructions. I take the pieces, kind of throw them out everywhere. I shake the board a bunch.
I
and then
eat
I'm done.
One of them. I throw one in the garbage.
There
and then
go.
I just
Smart.
Try to guess what this
I
game is.
I put one outside like it's moon water. You know what I mean?
I Hell do think you're right on the money there, Justin, because like you're saying, the first part of the book is all preparing, getting ready for the game. And then once they are in the like entry room for the tournament, it's laid out like a game board. That's what they're going on. So what I think Scott Snyder is telling us here, and they have been telling us all along, is the stakes are immeasurably high. People are going to quote unquote die over the course of this event, but we're going to have fun at the same time. And that's the same thing that he did with Dark Knight's Metal, where he's like, it's the end of the DC universe. Everything is on fire. The joke, the Batman who laughs is here. The dark multiverse is approaching. Also, there's a Joker dragon, you know? So that balance that he strikes, he does so well and he crushes it.
Yeah. Well, like the stakes are implicit because of just what the whole continuity is telling you. But the fact that it's a game, everyone knows it's a game, means that they're playing. So we get the play aspect of it.
Yeah, that whole Superman talking about like playing games thing was kind of weird.
Very cool. Yo, I love these Superman like knuckle dusters. Knuckle dusters. Awesome. But let me say, it reminded me a little bit of James Tynan IV's Exquisite Corpses book.
You're talking
that's
about
happening.
JT4?
JT4, yes. I said the long version, which is like a similar bracket-based fight, but this is going to be super condensed, and we're just going to get rocket-fueled through it, I think. So that's really exciting.
Can I call my shot here in the first issue, what I think is going to happen?
Yes.
No? Oh, I can't, Pete?
Yeah, move on.
Oh, okay. Never mind. No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to call my shot anyway. I think the thing that they're kind of leaving off the table here, the little part of the rule book that they're very purposefully ignoring, is they're talking so much about this Omega energy, and they're like, we got to gather Omega energy. We got to take heroes and make them dark and evil. And Superman the entire time was like, I don't know about this. I don't know if we should be doing this. Like we talked about in the DCKO podcast, he's definitely going to get to the edge. And I think we all kind of came to the same conclusion that like he'll be like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is alpha energy. Like that is, I think, going to be the revelation at the end here is like, oh, wait, we don't have to be bad. We can be good. And Superman, after everybody has lost and Darkseid has won the game, is going to realize I have the power to harness the alpha energy of this universe and fight back. That's where
because here's the thing. Because I was thinking this as well, and I think it means Superman is going to be outside of the game. I think Superman is going to go out of the tournament early, as we talked about in our group bracket. But I think it is going to – they make a lot of hay of alpha energy, something that has been left out of the materials about this event but is very important in the beginning of this story. And I think what we're going to get is, like you're saying, Superman will be gathering the alpha energy, especially as all these heroes go down, which means their alpha energy is up for grabs. He will absorb it, but he's going to beat Darkseid, and then I think he's going to have to fight whoever wins the tournament. And we're going to get a big, bad confrontation from someone he knows and loves, and I think it's going to be Supergirl. Juiced on Omega Energy, and we're going to get the thing that Alex predicted, potentially, is the flip of the Crisis panel with a jacked-up Supergirl holding a Superman who has been killed.
We'll see what happens. We are in for a wild ride over the next couple of months, and we'll be following along with our brackets. I know we've mentioned this a couple of times, but I want to throw it out to our listeners here as well. We each have our individual brackets. The idea is we're going to assign points over the course of the 5 months, see how close we get, and whoever loses is
Justin's already acting like he won.
A punishment. So let us know what you think the punishment would be. We had a good one on the live show, which is Pete has to do real trivia for a full month. I think that's pretty good, but you guys let us know in the
comments.
That's
a real burn.
What you think.
I have so much Omega energy right now about this term. I'm ready to fucking kill you guys.
I'm going to have some alpha energy about it and think about it positively.
Of course you are, loser.
Oh, my God. Transformers number 25
Come
from Skybound. And Image Comics written by Robert Kirkman, art by Dan Mora.
Kirkies.
Jorge Corona. This is a new era for Transformers, picking up with D.W. Day and Daniel Warren Johnson leaving the title. They do start off with Jorge Corona sort of passing the baton over to Dan Mora. First half of the issue, I agree, the first half of the issue focuses on Megatron doing a really nice roll call with all the Decepticons, just really checking in with
I knew
there's
like
so
that.
Much name checking. There's so much name checking in this issue that I loved Pete, it. I actually was useful.
It was very useful, and I feel like I'll refer to that a lot. Pete, a very curious person who has been talking nonstop about how much you hate business meetings, what you thought about the scene. We'll come back to that in a second. The second half of the issue is Optimus Prime and the Autobots helping out in Chicago, which is wrecked, trying to rebuild it alongside humans, when they're approached by somebody who seems to be from the U.S. Army, brokering a deal to help them out.
Oh, my God.
But the only thing is, the guy who is the leader of the organization that's going to help them out, who has so much energon, is a guy named Miles Mayhem.
Oh, my God!
Suspect name. Let me just say.
Mask has entered the fucking energon world. Like, what is happening?
Yes, as we all know, Miles Mayhem is the big villain from Mask. He was the leader of Venom. We all
that's
know
right.
this.
We all know
so,
this.
So, yeah, that's what we're getting here. Yes, exactly.
Oh, you guys all know this, do you?
Yeah, well, I didn't have
here's
to look
the thing.
It up or anything.
We talked about this
Wait,
a little bit.
So what does Venom stand for, assholes?
Viltrumites.
Very energon. Nom nom.
Okay.
Oh, nom nom nom.
Yum yum, very energon. Nom
yeah,
nom.
Yeah, yeah.
What does it stand for, Pete?
Wait. The villains evil network of mayhem. Come on.
Great.
Nice. Great. Oh, sorry. Just for those of you not watching, Pete just has, he's bleeding from his nose and eyeballs, if you recall. He went too deep into his nostalgia brain, and he's it's over for him. He's having
a
I was like,
full of blood.
Yeah, I was like, I almost had brain freeze there, trying to pull
He
that.
Went full 11 to remember Venom from Mask.
Dude. I like this issue. I thought this was very focused, both in terms of the Megatron story and the Optimus story. I do like working in this mask thing here. We were talking about the concept of mask, that like their trucks are turned into other trucks. Is that what it is?
It's a perfect companion to the energon universe, because it's like it's humans that drive trucks that turn into trucks.
Here's what I was thinking around.
Doesn't
this,
turn
and
into
I feel like,
other trucks. They turn into like weaponized
please
cars.
Get angry at me about this.
Yeah.
This seems a reasonable thing for human beings who are adults to get angry about. The thing that I think is so smart about the way they're setting this up, if this goes the way that I think it goes, is Mask on the surface, weird concept. Here, they're basically being like, oh, what if Transformers and G.I. Joe lead to Mask? Which makes, like, 100%. All the sense of the world.
It's well, so and honestly, I think Mask is a response to Transformers being in the world, and that's really smart, especially in this title so far, in the first 24 issues. Humans have been just things to crush, essentially, mm-hmm. or not crush. And I think the fact that humans can have a little power here, I think, is really good.
And I also think it's a good place to put Optimus in, where he's like, wow, I found these new allies that gave me two Transformers I thought were missing and all this energon. And he's going to get to a place where he helps build Miles Mayhem and Venom and feel crushed about it. And that's
yeah,
good.
First off, as a Transformers fan here.
First
this is,
off.
Yeah. You guys are.
Just
are
to what, start.
Yeah. I just want to say, coming from the guy with the Soundwave t-shirt, like, let's break this down a little bit more. First off, it's a sick cover, bro. You know, especially because Optimus got fucking wrecked in the last issue. So kind
it's
of
nice
cool
to see Optimus
nice.
Just be a truck for a while.
Yeah. And then, you know, we start with this Megatron kind of like roll call monologue thing, which I felt like was a little over the top. I'm sure you guys appreciated all the names of people that you didn't know. But I just think that, like, Megatron.
You knew all those names?
Yes, of course. I've watched all the shows and the movie numerous times. So, yes. But,
the Michael Bay one. The first one or
no,
Rise
the animated movie that this is all fucking based on. Please try to catch up.
So, are
you
talking
long
about
haul?
Revenge of the Fallen or Dark of the Moon?
No, neither of those. I'm talking about Transformers, the animated movie.
Tell me about Longhall's.
You're talking about
Longhall's personality. Oh, what's Longhall's vibe?
So I just felt like
First off, all I gotta say,
over the top Megatron speech was a bit much. Hearing him talk about peace was weird. Like, we will kill everybody for peace. I was like, this is like a peacemaker speech over here, where he's like, I'll kill anyone. So I felt like that was a little bit much. Also, like, the change from 24 to 25 was huge. Like, we were kind of slow playing everything, and this issue, like, so much goes down. It kind of breaks my brain. Like, the oh shit moment of mayhem was enough, but there was also all this other kind of stuff, and seeing like Optimus get duped was rough, where he was just like, oh, it seems like a hell of a deal, right? All the energon you can handle. And I was like, oh my god, this is not going to go well. So that kind of reveal was insane, but it really just set up so much. I love the art. I also did think they did a smart job of like that transition, like you said. So I'm very excited with what's to come. I was just surprised how jam-packed this was, and a little kind of overwhelmed.
I like the jam-packedness of it. I really liked the sticking with Jorge Corona for this first sort of coda on the Decepticon stuff, which I thought was great. I actually really liked the speech. I thought it was cool. And then the transition into the much cleaner art, really sort of shifting into a new era. Optimus Prime feels like he can chill a little bit and just be a truck, which, you know, everybody's dream. Truck.
I wanted to give a shout out to Dan Mora. Has this great split panel of a little girl, I believe, who has a mask on. It's like, you and me, we're the same. And there's this lovely split panel of Optimus and the little girl that I thought was really nice and just emphasizes everything that's been going out of the run about Optimus bonding with humans in a simple visual way, which was very cool to see.
Here's what I predict, though, on our Miles Mayhem. He's like, yeah, come hang out. Join us. Hang out. You met your old friends who we found hidden in places. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be like, we turned them. Now your friends are cars where jet skis shoot out of them. What do you think about that? And Optimus is going to be really sad because now his friends have boats. Like, they have boats coming out of them.
That's not something to be sad of. That's something to be proud of.
I thought I understood this mask thing, and then you mentioned some details down, Justin, and I don't get it anymore.
It's literally just trucks that boats come out of and helicopters
that
jet skis
shoot
out of.
That is not true.
It's like surprise cars.
But they also wear masks, right?
The humans wear masks.
Right. Yeah. Do they control the boat trucks?
Yes.
With masks?
Yeah, the masks let them turn their car into a boat if they need it.
Anybody else have Pete,
mask? Pete, you can be mad about this, but I'm saying everything is true that I'm saying.
You're being real douchey about it.
I'm not. I'm just saying the truth that it's like sometimes it's a jetpack that turns into like a backpack or whatever.
We're the pest nerds at Greenix, and we know bugs. Bundle pest and rodent control now and save $150. Visit greenixpc.com. Pests hate us. Customers love us.
All right. First off, I think we need to move on. Amazing Spider-Man Torn, number one from Marvel, written by J. Michael Straczynski. Art by Per Perez.
You're a piece of shit.
And scored by Natalie Imbruglia, I believe.
Yes. And tying into Tron, but they spelled it wrong.
Oh.
It takes place back in the day when Spider-Man was, per the title, torn between Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane. And enter that. We are getting a new villain here, a lady who turns into a demon.
Bummer. She kills librarians pretty recklessly.
Yeah, she kills
librarians. You don't need to kill a librarian.
Just to throw it out there, J. Michael Straczynski, I feel like people are very torn on his run on the book. He injected a lot of stuff in there, but there were a lot of controversial moments as well. I like the character stuff he brings with Harry and Gwen and MJ and Peter just kind of hanging out. I thought that was really well done. I don't understand thematically how it connects at all with the other half of the book.
Okay. I have a question. Did you guys think that the blonde lady who is the bad person was Gwen? Because the art was so similar.
I did.
That it was driving me fucking nuts.
I figured it out pretty quickly, but the first time when they went from a page of Gwen, who does not wear a headband in this book, to a page of a blonde lady, I was like, what's Gwen doing now?
And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not great. That's not great.
Yeah, that really threw me where I was like, why is Gwen all of a sudden acting like this? And then she's cool around Parker, but I was like, okay, maybe it's a split personality thing. But then when it went later on in the episode, I was like, oh, this is a completely different white lady.
But let me say, like, this is, I'm really enjoying the run that's happening on the flagship Amazing Spider-Man title that we've been talking about a lot.
Sure.
And this is, like, sort of the opposite side of that. Like, we have, it's a classic story back in the past. Spider-Man's very basic Spider-Man. We have our Gwen Stacy, Mary Jane, all that stuff. And this is a nice point counterpoint to be reading that book that has mm-hmm. Peter in space, some alternate Spider-Man on Earth doing different things. And this feels like a great – I actually think it's going to be nice to be reading these at the same time. I don't know what the story is going to be, but the relationship and interpersonal stuff from Peter, Gwen, Mary Jane, and Harry I really liked. So more of that, I think.
I'm just worried because it you know, Peter accidentally turns this lady into a demon and she flies off angry and he has the book. And I just feel like he's got to try to help her, but he also has so many other things going on that I'm worried if this gets backburnered, like that lady's really going to want her vengeance. You know what I mean?
Maybe he won't see her. Maybe she's just gone.
Yeah, maybe that's it for her. And the rest of it is just relationship drama. I guess we'll see. All right, moving on to another big issue, Absolute Batman number 13 from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Nick Dragota. We are getting towards the final battle with Bane here as Batman bonds with Catwoman. They spar a little bit. We get to see a love scene.
Oh, they spar all right.
Oh, they spar. We get to see a love scene back in the day. We also get a huge revelation of a character who was a big surprise unless you looked at the dumb site that leaked it several days prior to this. If you didn't know about that, awesome. But midway through the issue, we get to meet Absolute Harley Quinn, who was also kind of asterisk the Red Hood. So a lot of big stuff going down in this issue, though this is very much a preparation for the bigger battle that is to come in the next issue. But I got to tell you, good relationship drama. Also nice to take a one-issue break from the nonstop horror we've been experiencing in this title.
Agreed. I really liked the Catwoman stuff here. I would say like we get some flashback to them, but their sex scene is modern. Like that's him fully
That's right, yes,
in the venomed up body, so mm-hmm. That was just great, really well done. I love a quiet moment in a series that is just like so all go, and then you just get Catwoman a couple of panels later hooking her tail up to a gun and just laying out some people with some trank darts. That was cool. I thought the Harley revelation was great. It mm-hmm. rhymes really nicely with Joker and Red Hood history in the main continuity, which I thought was, again, Scott Snyder's brain just able to mix and match history with this Omega-infused Absolute Universe, which is really cool. This series just doesn't disappoint. I genuinely don't know what's going to happen, and mm-hmm. That's exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting. Sick cover, fun with the Catwoman. You know, kind of a little, you know, we get kind of the reveal that Batman's been juicing, been on the Bane juice, which is a little scary. But I guess in this absolute world, you got to kind of make these kind of decisions.
Has experimented on for the past several issues.
Yeah, it wasn't his bad.
It wasn't his choice.
Okay, well, he seems like he was pro it when they were talking.
He likes it now. Yeah,
yeah, he seems like he's into it. I guess you don't embrace what's happened to you, but
Pete, you get a carafe of fresh squeezed orange juice. You're not going to juice that juice.
Well, that's the thing, dude. If it's laced juice, you know, you got to be careful. You know, you can't just set moon water outside and hope it's going to be cool the next day. You can
do that.
Well, I don't recommend it. I don't recommend it. But I just think that like. I love the stakes. I also love the kind of cameos we get. We got this sweet panel, Killer Croc in there, Harley Quinn with the shaved head and the nunchucks. Awesome. Just fun choices. It's exciting to see these characters and how they look and feel in this, and I'm just having a blast.
Next up, Harley Quinn, X Elvira, number one from Dynamite, written by Jimmy Pamiotti and Amanda Connor, art by Amanda Connor and Juan Samu. You can probably figure out what's going on here, but This is Pamiotti and Connor going back to their lauded run on Harley Quinn, the days when she was living on Coney Island. You get to see a bunch of those jokes pop up here. But basically, yeah, this is, I think, exactly what you expect and therefore what you want out of a title like this. As Harley Quinn recruits Elvira for a Halloween party, they get mashed together. There's lots of raunchy jokes throughout. Great Amanda Connor art in particular at the beginning, and Juan Samu, I think, balances it nicely. So, enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Jimmy and Amanda working together, like they're, I'm so curious how they, I would love to just be in the room to hear them working, because it feels like they're just having a blast all the time. They know what they want to be doing. There's just great, the moment when Harley's on stage at Carnegie Hall, topless, I thought was really funny. They just really know how to get into their zone and live there for a comic like this.
Yeah, this is a blast. It's a great team. Great to see them back on this, having so much fun. And even the lettering is fun. I mean, there are so many cool kind of details about this. I love the tone of the art, just setting this kind of light, bright, fun world and just having a blast.
Next up, Superman, the Kryptonite Spectrum, number 3 for DC Comics, written by W. Maxwell Prince, art by Martin Marazzo. Over the course of this series, Superman and Batman have been experimenting with new types of kryptonite, and the new type of kryptonite last issue left him euthanized, is I believe the word, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so he is younger than he was before, and he's hanging out with Billy Batson, Shazam. Part of the issue is drawn to look like it is in crayon, and they battle a bunch of different folks at the same time. What'd you guys think about this one?
Yeah, this continues to be so fun with this kind of underlying creepy tone to it. Yeah, I love the line, this is the worst amusement park ever. That's fun. And then we got the big reveal here of that they haven't been kind of like testing kryptonite, that this is all an evil plot by Mixleplick. So that's fun. And
that little bastard.
Yeah, and it makes a lot more sense now with all the things that have been going wrong. And so, yeah, I'm having a blast with that. And that's a fun reveal by this team. This has just been such a creepy blast in such a unique way. It continues to be awesome.
The sense of dread that that W. Maxwell Prince and Martin Marazzo bring to this is awesome. Like, it is a flavor we rarely get with any sort of book in the Superman side of things, and it's really exciting. I love we get to see them draw, Martin Marazzo draw the Batcave. We get a lot of just great moments, and W. Maxwell Prince just hitting us with some really fun lines. There's a great Lois Lane, Lex Luthor scene. It's just top-notch across the board, and a flavor you won't get anywhere else.
Marvel Knights, Punisher, number 1 from Marvel, written by Jimmy Pabiotti, art by Dan Panosian. This is part of the Marvel Knights The World to Come world that was started with the Black Panther book that is now continuing with this. They seem to be only tangentially related by the Marvel Knights name and the fact that Jimmy Pabiotti was part of Marvel Knights back in the day. But this is giving us a tale of a older Punisher with a new skull on his chest, fighting his way against a drug that is called Zombie, that does exactly what his name implies, without the flesh eating, but basically turns people into brainless thugs who follow your every command. Pete, you're our Punisher guy. You must have loved what FBI Director Cash Patel was doing the past week, handing out these challenge coins, and now this. Go ahead.
Oh, man. So I was very excited to see this in the stack, so much so that I couldn't wait to read it. Like, normally when we get this stack, I have, like, little treats in different parts of the stack for myself.
Mean you hide, like, donuts in between comics?
Yeah, pages. Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly right. But I just I couldn't wait. I was so excited. Palmiotti is an amazing writer. I feel like he's in a great kind of wheelhouse for this. It seems like a perfect thing for him. I couldn't have been more disappointed with what happened.
Whoa.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. The last thing that happens is the Punisher kills a family, kind of like what happened to him and his family at a picnic. And
ironic.
I just was like, that's the last thing the Punisher would want to do. And it was fucking heartbreaking to see it. Also, his shirt makes it look like it's a pumpkin.
That bothers you, the pumpkin part?
Yeah, the pumpkin part.
Just in time for Halloween?
Yeah. So I was just like, I went from a real high to a real low. And
well, what did you think about the fact that by the end of the issue, they're calling him the Pumpkiner? Did that bother you as well?
Yeah, I also didn't like that part.
And that they hollowed him out and put a candle in him and he glowed beautifully.
Yeah, also zombie Punisher makes me think of Frankenstein Punisher, which was not fun for me, but maybe for some other people.
Mm, conjuring up a past, quote-unquote, trauma. Yeah. I actually really enjoyed this. I really like Dan Panosian's art. I feel like it adds a nice sort of, even though it's set vaguely in the future, it has a more classic feel to it, which matched well with this type of Punisher story where it's not glorifying him as much as just having him be a force that is going in one direction and then by the end is killing a family. So that was tragic. But the amount of torture that the Punisher goes through, I feel like is a lot. And I like his new pumpkin look.
Yeah. Oh, you like the pumpkin look.
I also like the pumpkin look, and I appreciated not having the classic skull. I've talked about this before, but nothing against the creators involved, but it doesn't sit right to me that Marvel waited like a year, 2 years, and then we're like, it's okay to bring back Frank Castle with the classic skull. Let's go. Here we go. When it is still a problem, I was joking about the Cash Patel thing, but if people don't know, like, he handed out these challenge coins to people he thinks are doing a good job, which is like a gold Punisher symbol with guns instead of teeth, and it's just part of the section of society that uses the Punisher symbol to try to justify extrajudicial actions. I don't like it. Like, and Jerry Conway, co-creator of the Punisher, doesn't like it. I appreciated the fact here, at least, that they're continuing to give a stretch in a different direction versus what they're doing in the mainline universe.
Well, and like, you know, taking the politics out of it, I just think the image itself has been co-opted. It means something else now. So, like, I think, to your point, it needs to be different because otherwise it just takes you out of the story. Avoiding the politics from a pure storytelling point of view, it makes it harder to get on board with the character.
Yes. And this is just supposed to be, this felt to be a lot like Garth Ennis, Max Punisher, down to the Panosian art. So sorry you didn't like it, Pete, but I also did. Conan the Barbarian, number 25 from Titan Comics, written by Jim Zub, art by Alex Horley. We actually talked to Jim Zub about this issue a few weeks back on the podcast, so do check that out. But the big highlight here, beyond it being a 25, is Alex Horley fully painted the entire issue, and not just on comic book pages, but like made multiple paintings that they somehow, of different sizes, that they
different
somehow.
Different sizes. That was the crazy part.
Yeah, that they had to figure out how to get in this. Yes.
It is funny. Like, that's not something I knew that a lot of artists did, but we talked with Robert Kirkman and
David Finch.
Yeah. David Finch about this in the book that they're working on, where he was doing like these huge poster sized panels for the entire issue. Wow. And then to have Jim Zub talk about Alex Horley doing these in all different size canvases, I was like, that's madness.
Yeah.
But in the book, like, it's really cool. Talking to Jim about it, like, it harkens back while looking forward in a really smart way. The art reminds you of just like sort of the Frank Frazetta origins of Conan's imagery in our brains in a really cool way. Jim also talked about like positioning Conan in throughout the different eras. Like, this book jumps around from Conan's history, and this we're getting an older Conan. And I think it was nice to see that here in the 25th issue. And but still, like, looking back at the history, we get a little bit of Belit, a character I really like, later on in the book. And I don't know, it's just a great milestone comic to jump into, even if you haven't been reading the comic before, because this does stand alone.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think this is a good jumping on point, which is nice, especially for an issue 25, which doesn't maybe seem so. Check it out. But I think that the art is absolutely spectacular. It really makes a difference when you're kind of sucked into this world. It does such an amazing job. So just feels more epic and just kind of helps kind of transport you away. And I was impressed with how cool Conan was. Like, you know,
he's this a cool dude.
Guy shows up being creepy, and he's like, "Hey, you can stay." You know what I mean? And I was like, "Wow, look at Conan just being so nice."
Mikasa es su casa, says Conan. Yeah,
so Conan, gets a lot of heat for being a tyrant and a ruler and all that kinds of stuff. But I thought he was really nice to his guest and very respectful. And, I thought it was kind of a fun book. And, art's worth it. Just worth it.
Well, he lived a big life before he was king. It's like if we had to give up our podcast and become king and all of our great podcast enemies came back to haunt us.
We should do a bunch of episodes where we flash back to being teen podcasters. What was that like?
Well, man,
it's really good.
The Sacrificers, number 16 from Image Comics, written by Rick Remender, art by Max Fumara. Big stuff going down this issue.
Yeah.
As Pigeon goes straight for the Sun King, with the Sun King's daughter looking on, leading to what sure seems like the death of several main characters by the end here. What'd you guys think about this one?
Well, first off, epic cover, amazing team. Love the artwork. It's hard to draw someone who is mostly made of fire, but really impressive stuff here, especially that kind of like dying monologue that he gives. Just so heart-wrenching in all the right ways. That father-daughter talk was just so powerful. Really amazeballs art, super tight nanners here. I loved the art, the paneling, just really impressive panels.
Yeah, this guy's Firestorm all the way down. He's a full body Firestorm. Something you.
How many people are hard inside? Do you think?
I don't know. I guess it could be one, but it could be many. He does seem to consume other creatures around him. The comic has been off for a little bit, I believe, and we're coming back with this issue for a new arc where some big stuff happened, as Alex says. I was just thinking, I can't believe it's only been 16 issues. Mm-hmm. So much has happened in this comic. Our main character has gone so far. We've seen so much of this world. It's a classic dark Remender tale that is just so beautiful to look at, with great art backing it up from Max Fumara.
Yeah.
Return to Planet Hulk, number one for Marvel, written by Greg Pak, art by Carlo Pagulian. This is a one-shot set during the events of Planet Hulk to celebrate the 25th anniversary. It can't possibly be 25th anniversary, really, of the event?
I think 20.
Whew. Okay. Oh, boy. Anyway, we are returning to Planet Hulk. Pete, you're always on Planet Hulk in some way. What'd you think?
I thought it said on the cover 25.
Well, it might be.
Let's just say 25 years.
There's a little Hulk in front of it, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah, very hard to tell. But this is just what a great idea by Marvel to celebrate this, to have Greg Pak back and kind of do a special thing. I love this. I also thought it was super smart of the Hulk to go somewhere where Banner can exist. Such a good move.
It's 20th. It says 20th in the lower section. The cover.
Just really, and he likes fighting machines because no one gets hurt. This is just so much fun. Great art, great action. The kind of like montage splash page was epic. You know, one of my favorite like Hulk love stories there. This is just such a great kind of homage to an amazing event and updated in such a cool way. I had a blast with this.
Yeah, I like jumping back to a particular moment in the run and telling a more extended story that feels very emotional from a character that in this part of the story, we were just mostly observing. Mm-hmm. And it was all about being sort of hard and mad and sad. And so to be able to ride along with him a little bit, I thought was just a really smart place to position the story. So shouts to Greg Pak, someone who, again, is also very thoughtful about the stories that he wants to tell.
Hell of a writer.
Great writer, and the art was really, really matched the story as far as just big smash-em-up fight in the Marvel style.
Batman Dark Patterns, number 11 from DC Comics, written by Dan
Fire
Waters.
Fire Baby!
Fire Baby!
Hayden Sherman, starring Fire Baby, the breakout character of the season. There are multiple firebugs in town, and Batman is trying to track them down before they kill somebody or burn more things to the ground. And yeah, Pete, you still creeped out by Fire Baby?
Yes, very much so. Are you fucking kidding me? First off, cool cover.
Is it the fire or the baby?
It's both. It's a nightmare of both things. But I also, you know, I love when Alfred helps. You know what I mean? Like, that's always just such a fun thing. That is a fun running bit. And I'm glad that we got that in this issue. Great art, great action. It's
is this
kind
the
of
one
funny.
Where Alfred, sorry, is this the one where Alfred is like, oh, yes, you're the big, scary Batman?
Yes. I was going to say, it's funny you liked Alfred. He was talking shit in this comic.
He says, but he's alive and he helps. So
Bruce is like, I'm not a child, Alfred. And Alfred's like, no, you're a very big, scary Batman, Master Bruce. And just like puts him down.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I'm so used to absolute Batman. It's funny. It's kind of weird to see regular sized Batman. You know what I mean?
That's cool. I think it's all right. What do you think? I think about the way that Bruce surrounds himself with books in a circle. Do you guys ever do that if you're literally looking something
up? Yeah, yeah. It's a great way to kind of, you know.
I never understand that. They always have that scene with like an investigator where they're sitting and they're like, I need to put everything out on the floor. The only thing I can think during this scene is like, you're going to have to clean that up at some point, and that's going to be annoying.
It's visually cool.
All
right.
For sure.
It is.
But is it helpful?
Not helpful.
We got an amazing panel where it's just kind of like the cowl with the white eyes. That was just such an epic panel. And the kind of building and the stuff that happens in here with all the kind of story and action. And the art is unbelievable. The fire stuff, especially when it was that big panel around all the columns, was insane. So really impressive art by Hayden there.
Yes, fire babies, they make our dreams come true.
Oh, nightmares.
Mary Sue, number one for Boob Box, written by Megan Fitzmartin, art by Lisa Sterl. This is following a girl who is obsessed with a show called Riverview that seems to be a mix of Riverdale, Supernatural, and maybe the Vampire Diaries as well, basically like a CW mashup.
Good call, you little teen.
She writes fanfic about it, and it's pretty popular fanfic as well, or potentially really popular fanfic, and she has her own character, her Mary Sue, her stand-in character for herself in there, who knows everything and does everything, and people are obsessed with it. Unfortunately, in the real world, she is bullied in school until her character shows up in real life in classic 80s movies fashion.
Just classic. What did
you guys think about the kickoff issue to this?
Wait, and you say 80s movie fashion. What do you mean by that? Like mannequin?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking about. There's another movie that I'm thinking about where Last Action Hero, maybe. I don't know.
Wow. Okay.
That's 90s.
That was exactly.
No, there's definitely a movie that I'm thinking about where somebody's made-up character shows up in real life.
Drop Dead Fred? What you mean?
It's definitely not that either. You're correct. But
there's plenty of rom-coms where stuff like that happens. Anyways.
There's plenty where... Here's the thing. You guys are saying stuff that I don't think is real.
This happens all the time.
The old my thing I created came back to life, and it's a whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, this world I created.
What about Romancing the Stone?
They're real.
She's just a writer,
but that isn't Michael Douglas, her character creation, who shows up?
Well,
and then
he's
same thing
real
with
person.
The Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum movie?
Well, that's a little bit closer to that, yeah.
Nice. Classic
it's also like a
fair.
Cool world thing where they kind of create a world and then they're
in it. Cool world. These are all movies we're naming.
Yeah.
Yes, so you guys are really good at just saying stuff that is definitely not 80s, by the way. I almost thought that was 80s. Yeah, good.
That's not 80s. Definitely not.
Classic Mary Sue dinosaurs. I really enjoyed this. That's why I want to get the references right. This is a fun story that did some great setup, and so the reveal really popped.
Yeah, also I like the Riverdale kind of references. That was fun. But the classic parents just don't understand to ruin everything, right? Right, you guys? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's actually one of the things that I really appreciated about this book beyond Lisa Stirl's art, which I think is really engaging. It's cartoony without going too over the top, but it really draws you into these characters. Is there's a real consideration for the quote unquote real characters in this book, including our main character, but even her bully. There's a fair amount of sympathy for her and her mother, to the point that you were saying about the parents just don't understand. She is very religious. She doesn't want her watching Riverview and getting involved in that sort of thing, and talks to her about how fiction is not real life. I certainly have some strong feelings about that because I know a lot of people in fic communities and other fan communities who are involved in that. And I do think there is a way of getting into that and making that your real life and that being more real than the life you're in certain ways. But I think they do a really good job of straddling the line where you understand where the mother is coming from as well. And they're also not using religion as a, like, I guess we would say footloose type situation where they're really pushing back against the, you know, the thing that the youths want to do in the town.
Sure.
I'll
sure.
give you a footloose on this one, but you're yeah. really, you're on notice, Alex. Thanks, so you're on notice.
Movie cop.
yeah.
Well, also, reference questions. I want to lay out a bunch of movie DVD cases in a circle around myself and see if I can find what the
That's how you get. About. That's how you imbibe it. Also, yeah. the art has a really nice kind of watercolor feel to it, which is fun.
Yeah.
The first thing I got when I searched for 80s movie fictional character shows up in real life is Max Headroom, which is definitely not correct.
See, now you're being punished for your hubris right now.
Imperial Guardians, number one from Marvel, written by Dan Abnett and Jonathan Hickman, art by Corey Smith and Luca Maresca. This is another one-shot spinning out of the Imperial event. Here we are following Gamora and Darkhawk as months
Shouts.
Earlier, before the event, they are investigating a mystery, trying to figure out why Varank, who is the Skrull who was behind Secret Invasion, has somehow come back to life. They're joined briefly by Captain Marvel, and then there's some big twists by the end as they find out the mystery of Imperial months before anybody else, and it leads to a shocking climax that I certainly wasn't expecting, and I'm curious where it's going, given we know there is a Imperial Guardians series that is coming next year.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I like these characters. This is very complicated. It's wild to me. This event feels like it should have been over, like, a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've moved on, and, like, honestly, there's a bunch of Revelation books that we're going to talk about in this, the X-Men, and they sure. that's sort of eating all the air in the Marvel side of things. So it is strange that this is still happening, but I do like the story. I like Darkhawk as a character, and a character who is, like, trying to figure it out, but there's a lot of mysteries, doesn't understand the way his powers work super well. I like Gamora partnering with him, taking a break from the Peter Quill of it all. Captain Marvel, I feel like she's sort of like, yeah, I'm here for a minute, but I'm busy. Like, she doesn't seem to want to be in this crossover either. So, I don't know, the vibes on this are a little bit. We get a cosmic Ghost Rider appearance.
Hell yeah.
Which is cool, but I was like, wait. Is he, because if we remember, Cosmic Ghost Rider is Frank Castle with the cosmic power and Ghost Rider power. And I'm like, how's this working?
Yeah, and he's funny. He's very funny. He's like Deadpool. Funny. He is very winky at the camera. And he traveled back in time with a baby Thanos. And now he lives in this time period.
Yeah, which so that's weird. It's mm-hmm. just a weird idea. It took my head a minute to be like, right, when I saw him appear here.
Yeah, especially because what he does really fucks shit up. But yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I like the story, the interesting characters, and I liked how like defensive they got when Captain Marvel was on. Like, oh, we were just hanging out. We're just nothing to do. And you're like, oh, okay, sure. So I thought that was all fun. Great art, tons of action, and Cosmic Ghost Rider doesn't make sense to me, but I do like Cosmic Ghost Rider as a character just because it looks cool.
Do you think Maximus from the Inhumans stopped Cosmic Ghost Rider and said, hey, crazy when you were El Zombie and you killed that family with a Gatling gun?
Yeah.
Do you have any memory of that? And Frank would be like, life's pretty loose, right, brother? Or whatever he says.
That's his catchphrase. That's the Punisher's catchphrase.
Yeah. I mean, he's like very much like, I don't always drink beer. When I do, I drink Dos Equis or something. He's like saying man in the random universe. Stuff.
Death to Pachuco, number one from Image Comics, written by Henry Barras, art by Rachel Merrill. This is a detective story focusing on a bunch of characters. Feels very Chinatown-esque to me.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Really like the art style in here in particular.
Yes. But
what did you guys think about this book?
Yeah, I agree. The art style, I love the kind of vibe it has to it. Fun twists and turns, fun detective story. You get a little bit of history in there, which is cool. Yeah, I was kind of into this and won over by the art, and I'm excited to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the history here. Like, particularly there's a moment where, I mean, there's a lot of like dealing with race in this comic, and there's this moment in Pasadena, which they're referencing as the Sundown Town, and that's something that I feel like you read about in the Deep South, but very rarely. I was thinking that Pasadena was a sundown town was surprising to me, and that's the kind of stuff that I really drew me into this book. So I'm definitely on board for the next issue.
Next up, Batman, The Long Halloween, The Last Halloween, number 9 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Loeb, art by Chris Samnee. Great Chris Samnee art, as usual, in this issue.
Yes, yeah.
Alex, a halting review from Alex Alvin on this.
I really like Chris Samnee's art. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, I hear you. And yeah, we get a fun Tim Sale cover on this, too, which is great. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
I think you hear what I'm not saying is what you're saying.
I hear what you're not saying for sure.
Okay, cool.
Pete, did you like the story in this?
I was trying to get to that if we could.
Please.
Enjoyed this fun twist ending. The kind of Joker making deals. You can't trust him, man. The guy's crossed some fingers. Oh, man. He's like an old 70s TV show. But, I don't know. I'm still kind of having nostalgia fun with this, and you know, Catwoman has a mom, so that's exciting for her.
Well, you're having nostalgia fun, meaning it reminds you of the Long Halloween.
Exactly.
So you're not actually liking this story.
I am liking the story. It, you know, maybe not be up to the Zalbatron standards, but. Just on
what about the Pete standard? Like, are you getting a little donut in between each page, a little Pete sweet treat?
I don't know, maybe a donut hole, but yeah, I'm still having fun with this. Just you know,
donut hole.
Yeah,
I always feel like donut hole is short for donut butthole. That's me. And
what?
Try to
really?
Unhear. Try to unhear that. I don't know. It feels that way.
Okay,
but I actually thought this issue was pretty good. I know we haven't read this for a couple issues, I feel like.
Nope, it hasn't come out for a while.
Oh, is that true? Okay, yeah. Well, then I'm definitely keeping up with the story. But I did like this issue. I think the Chris Samnee art is excellent, but this is the part of the story where I think Jeff Loeb actually shines a little bit more, when all of the disparate parts are coming together, and we're getting to see some of that payoff, and the writing and the art are really hitting synergy point. So I did enjoy this. It is a little convoluted in general, I think.
Honestly, that is my issue. I agree with you that this one is a step up, particularly when we're focusing on the Two-Face stuff that's going on here. I thought was interesting, and Pete called out the Joker scene. I thought that was well done too, but there's so much going on, and to a fault, Long Halloween is simple and straightforward. Like, there are twists and turns in the mystery, but you really can follow that very straightforward, because you're like, it's this holiday, and now it's this villain, and it's this holiday, and now it's this villain. And this is like so many trains going at the same time.
Well, and I feel like this book is trying to absorb everything that's come before, and it doesn't have to do that. Like, mm-hmm. we know that that happened. This can stand on its own a little bit. But there's a lot of recap happening in here at the same time, which makes it extra complicated.
Yeah. Strange Tales, number one from Marvel, written by Jeremy Whitley, art by Bailey Underwood. In this issue, we get Nico Minoru and Scarlet Witch teaming up, and it seems like this title is going to be magical character team up, basically, is what's going on here. And if so,
cool. Yeah.
Fun, I'm on board.
Agreed.
What I really liked about this, I liked the art a lot. I thought it was mm-hmm. really nice matching with the story that was very Dungeons and Dragons rooted. Yeah. And honestly, this is one of the best versions of like a Dungeons and Dragons game that characters are playing that spills over into a larger adventure. I thought the logic
of it was...
Be careful,
dude. Die was awesome, bro.
Die was very good. That was a little more about a plot. It was told over a long period of time. I thought as a standalone issue, this was able to give us the mechanics of how the universe worked at the same time it was telling us an interesting story. And I thought the mechanic was actually a very smart version of that. Yeah. So that was really cool to see. And I was pleasantly surprised this is an ongoing, it feels mm-hmm. like.
Yeah, that's very exciting. I feel like Strange Tales is such a kind of staple in comics. It's such a kind of
featured
epic,
recently in trivia.
Yeah, it's an epic, important thing in comics. So I was very happy to see this back. I love the swings that this comic has taken over the years. So I was excited about this. And I feel like they did such a good job with the fantastic art that sets such a nice tone, has a cool vibe to it. Love this kind of witches team up with a little D&D sprinkled in there. Yeah, I, you know, don't get Jumanji'd. You know, this is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. A lot of characters playing, heroes playing games in this stack.
Yeah.
Let me just shout out real quick. I really like the convention of Scarlet Witch's The Last Door, where heroes will tumble through into her sort of sanctum, sanctorium. And I think that was a Steve Orlando creation for when he launched his Scarlet Witch title.
Yeah.
And I like that that's being carried out.
Agreed. Next up, The Power Fantasy, number 12 from Image Comics, written by Kieran Gillen, art by Casper Wingard. The big cliffhanger at the end of the last issue was that Etienne, who is sort of our Professor X character, was killed, completely disintegrated, blown up. The power hierarchy of the Power Fantasy universe changed forever, except there's some even bigger twists this issue as we find out about Etienne's backstory, leading to a surprising return and a setup for even more power changes to come. This book continues to be great every single issue. Fantastic art, fantastic story. It's surprising. It's complicated. One of the best books on the stands.
Like a fantastic chess match that we get to witness with the most. You ever remember Battle Chess?
Mm-hmm. Oh, like, yeah.
Yes.
The chess pieces like would fight. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of that while I was reading this, where it really is just like... the strategy is excellent. It's when we talked to them at last year's New York Comic Con, that was my big takeaway. Is they're so careful with this book, and they think every move out to the maximum version of it. So continues to be very impressive.
Speaking of very impressive, I thought the way Zalbin summed this up was very impressive. I don't have any notes or things to add, but I did think of Zalbin while I was reading this, because this reminded me of what it must have been like for Alex to go to Cornell, where he's just his giant evil brain getting bigger mm-hmm. from knowledge. So, you know, shouts out to the Zalbatron.
Thanks. What was it like going to Ithaca College where your brain just kept getting smaller?
Yeah, exactly. They were just like, don't worry about your brain, drink. And I was like, yes, sir.
The professor said that?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir. Whatever you want, sir.
Well, we just discussed earlier how you don't drink tequila anymore because of a particular experience of waking up in a bush.
That was when I finished my proposal for the research project that we were doing, an insane class that they no longer do make the kids do that because they all went insane. So
called Comic Book Club.
Yeah, it was called Documentary Research, where you had to pitch two documentaries to a panel, and it was crazy stressful. And our research proposal was 735 pages. It was insane.
What?
Wow. Yeah.
Dude, the guy who... We had to split it into two. The guy who was presenting This amazing smart guy who spent so much of his time researching anything was so stressed when he got to the podium, he keeled over and I like dove to try to catch him. It was crazy.
Did you guys
and I
fall in love?
No, but yeah. I drank myself silly that night from the relief of after we performed and I woke up in bushes the next day and then swore off tequila.
Wow.
And that was the documentary that you sold.
Yeah. The documentary we were pitching was Edward Ruloff, The Learned Murderer.
There you go. Oh, awesome.
Pete, dropping some college knowledge.
I love this. I love this backstory. I love this Pete lore. Event Horizon, Dark Descent, number 2 from IDW, written by Christian Ward. Art by Tristan Jones. This is a prequel to the cult classic movie where we follow the ship, the Event Horizon, find out what happened when they activated their gravity drive and went to hell. And in this issue, they're in hell. They're in hell, all right, with all the eyeballs inside the ship and demons wandering.
Stop with the eyeballs, dude. Oh, my God. I forgot about the eyeballs for a second.
Man, the pace on this book is crazy to me because the first issue, I was like, ooh, this is such an interesting, tense setup of these characters. We're getting to know them. Things are starting to go wrong. And this issue is like, well, eyeballs all over the ship, and here's the Lord of Hell. Nothing to be done. And it just, like, went from not even zero, but like 50 to 1,000 from issue 1 to issue 2.
But I mean, I appreciate that.
That's great.
Especially for a book where the premise is like, you know, aliens, right? Well, what if the aliens were just your own fucked up life? And it's like, touche, comic book. These people are just cursed by the things they've done in their lives. And it's really good, really horrifying. I think the art really works with the writing of this. And the biggest thing is Event Horizon. It reminds me how fucked up of a movie that was.
It definitely makes me want to watch it again. I don't think I've watched it since.
But I'm a little scared to
watch it. It's Halloween week. Halloween month.
It's Halloween week.
It's Halloween week. You got a week. And then you're done.
Man. Yeah, this was insane. The kid getting run over was insane. The eyeballs was insane. This was so gross and so creepy. I wrote I'm grossed out numerous times in my notes here, but I was impressed artistically and what they're doing. You know, sometimes you just wait for your dad in hell, you know, no big deal.
No big deal. Yep. High Strangeness, book 1, 1967, number 1 from Odie Press and Spectravision, written by Chris Condon and Daniel Noah, art by Jave Chisholm. This is a new, I would say, prestige format series that's going to embrace different true weird stories, very similar to what Michael Avon Oeming and James Dunn IV are doing over in Blue Book, but a little less documentary, a little more pulpy, at least it seems, based on the first issue. This one is dealing with little gray men, particularly among other things, and investigating that. Justin, you love the Condon. What'd you think about this book?
I really liked it. I feel like the art style is giving this like a little bit more, like you compare it to Blue Book, which is more doc. This is a little more campy, has a little bit more of a flavor to it with the art, which I think really works with the more psychedelic sort of twisty experience that our main character is going through in his exploration of the high strangeness of it all. But I like this. I'm curious. The book one, 1967 of it all, it has me thinking, where is this going to go? What's the overarching plan? So I look forward to getting deeper into that.
I believe, by the way, I could be wrong about this, but I believe it's a different writer-artist team every issue other than Daniel Noah, who is the Spectravision guy. So you're going to get a new tale and a new time period next issue, but I could be wrong.
Interesting.
Cool.
Well, I was really thrown by how creepy the cover was, and I was not looking forward to reading this, but then I was pleasantly surprised by the inside. I also love...
That's the good thing about comics is there's a lot of inside.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, Justin.
I would never.
And so, yeah, I also love the little details of the art, like the way they drew the kind of smoke and stuff was giving clues to how the character felt. I thought that was really cool. Love the art style. So unique. It had this kind of off-putting thing, like things aren't right kind of tone to it, which I think really kind of fit this story. Yeah, just really impressive. I'm excited to see what happens next.
Yeah. Well, what happens next is that, folks, the revelation has begun.
It's the Marvel block.
All joy to Revelation. We are going to be doing our Age of Revelation block. I guess we'll see how long we keep this up. But as Justin mentioned earlier in the podcast, this is the big X-Men event that's taking over the whole line for the next 3 months.
And beyond.
Yes, we got a Zero issue, an Overture issue that happened last week. And the setup here is that 10 years in the future, Doug Ramsey, a.k.a. Revelation, has taken over a chunk of America and changed the world, killed off a bunch of people, elevated other people to mutant status, is about to move into phase two. And in the midst of this, whatever is left of the X-Men have taken the brains of Cyclops and Beast, moved them forward to their bodies in the future. And their goal, their mission is to kill Revelation. That is what they're trying to do. So I'll just mention, I read them all individually. We can talk through them each individually. But we're going to be talking about Amazing X-Men, Binary, Laura Kinney, Sabretooth, Long Shots, and World of Revelation all came out today. Before we get into them individually, I am curious to hear, since I think we were a little mixed on the kickoff, how do you feel about week one of Age of Revelation? Just overall, broad strokes.
It's interesting how deep into our stack this block is. I'm just saying that as a point of anecdotal observation.
Is that an observation about it or about what maybe I think of it?
That's exactly. I'm observing my man Alex, who has an X in his name. So he's part of this. But I do. It's a literal mixed bag of things happening here. I like some of these things. I feel like this world is interesting. It's almost, it's strangely like Age of Apocalypse is the natural comparison here, which, you know, had a, that felt more like the absolute universe, which was like, there was an overall darkness, a pall over the whole thing, but everyone was still like sort of having a spirit. There was still like a sort of animating principle for all of them. This so far, and again, it's early, it's only week 1.5 really on this. There, everyone is just mad. And like, there's a, just a weird sort of, it's like, you know, when you, it's like sucking on a penny. It's like a little metallic and cold to the story, especially this Amazing X-Men book where Cyclops is just mad the whole time. And the Beast is sort of being suspicious, like everything. I don't know who to like in this.
Yes.
And I want to like it. I like a lot of the ideas here. The way this is pinned into the 3K characters is a little characters that were introduced in Jed McKay's main book in the regular continuity. And like, I just don't know. They didn't have enough time to percolate to be such a hook here. This guy, what is it, Schwartzwelder or Schwarzschild something?
I don't know. Whatever his name is, I keep being like, is that their accountant? Are they talking about what is going on here? Because it just sounds like a regular
Schwarzschild.
It just sounds like a regular human last name, not a supervillain name. And that is confusing to me.
And he's strange because he has like Cyclops energy. His powers are built around like a harness that hangs over him. It's a little, I just don't know. That character seems, I don't know why he's being pushed to the forefront.
Well, before we
so
get
much.
To specifically into Amazing X-Men, Pete, what's your overall thoughts on week one of Age of Revelation?
Yeah, so I was like, okay, this is a thing. And by the time I read World of Revelation, I was already over this thing. Revelation looks like he is a cross between Apocalypse and a creepy pope. And
whoa, that's very accurate, I think, actually.
Oh, thanks.
Which is good, I think.
And yeah, I mean, I was like, okay, cool. Like Amazing X-Men number one, let's go. And then it was all just kind of downhill. But maybe it'll win me over by the time this you know, so.
So, Pete.
Yeah, what do you think, Alex?
I was just going to get into this first issue, but if you want to talk about the
next issue, I'd love to also offer my opinion, if that's okay.
No, yeah.
Oh, okay, thanks, great. I always want to check with you. I want to make sure it's okay with you before I talk about my opinion.
Yeah. Pete's our opinion trafficker.
Not to get too wonky about it, part of the reason that I put it so low in the stack was initially I was going to put it third after Transformers and DCKO, and then I was like, are we really going to talk about five comic books right after that, right at the top of the stack? That doesn't seem that fun to me. And I think that does point to one of the issues here is it's a lot of stuff with not a lot of focus. And what I think we need for this book is for this event is a spine book, because right now I'm not quite sure where to look. Like I'm not quite sure. There's a lot of things that are happening that I do think, to say maybe a little more positive than you guys, I was surprised how much of this I did like of these five books. And what I
of
did
the books, I agree.
Yeah, what I came out being like, oh, I actually really enjoyed this as an individual issue. But as an overall event, putting out 16 different books, but not knowing which ones, like, okay, is Amazing X-Men important? Is Laura Kitty Sabretooth important? And importance isn't the only thing, but, like, what is the story that we're telling with Age of Revelation? We talked about this with the issue last week, but if it's, like, Cyclops and Beast are like, well, shouldn't do that. At the end of the day, like, I don't know that that's a much of a story, if that's the takeaway, versus... again, I just don't know where we're focusing. I'm just repeating myself at this point.
A couple things. I mean, I would say a couple things on that. First off, this reminds me of the conversation we had on our live show where we talked about the power of editorial. Mm-hmm. And what I think is working so hard in DCKO and all of their event books is a strong editorial hand that is giving you the spine of the story even as there are so many details. DCKO is jammed with details. But I think and this event is as well, but they don't seem to have the spine that you're asking for. And I do think a stronger hand on it would give us that maybe a little bit more. And secondarily, I feel like this Amazing X-Men issue sort of makes me think there's something, some sort of scam or trick happening here. It sort of puts out there that maybe this isn't real. Beast is already catching on to that idea. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I would like this to at least be real because there are some interesting things at play here. I like the idea that Revelation is like, I'm the savior for mutants. And other people are like, no. I really like this thing that he does called babbling, where he takes language away from the characters. It's very horrifying. Mm-hmm. And he's done it too. We get to see that happen in one of these issues.
Well,
and it was...
Why don't we talk about them issue by issue? The first one is Amazing X-Men number one from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Mahmoud Azrar. And like we talked about a little bit, this does seem like maybe it's the spine book here because we're following Cyclops and Beast as they travel across the country with these new remains of the X-Men to kill Revelation. And I would say, like, I have not been loving Jed McKay's X-Men run, but this is one of the ones that I really liked because this has a really good, very propulsive The Fugitive feel where they're staying one step ahead of this feral Revelation corrupted Wolverine and other people who are chasing them. They end up in another weird place by the end of the issue. So I ended up, this is one of the ones that I ended up liking quite a bit.
Okay, well, I was like, I thought it was a fun kind of like start to this comic, but then I was like, man, this Cyclops is just being a nightmare to be around. But the art is interesting because it feels off, you know, like the colors that we're used to these characters are different. So I feel like that's kind of like
Beast
telling.
Gone gray.
Yeah, and then it's like, hey, man, do you want to see the worst Cyclops ever? I'm like, no. They're like, hey, how about your favorite character, Wolverine, just being used as a pawn? I was like, man, this is missing me on a lot of areas. But when they did kind of get to the last portal at the end that Alex had mentioned, I thought that was an interesting kind of cool panel, the Dark Child and stuff like that. So I had I had some – Psylocke looks sad as fuck, though. I had a little bit of like, oh, maybe there's some hope Yeah.
How do you feel? How do you feel them drawing Cyclops as a younger you? Because you have the same beard.
It is interesting that he does look like you.
Well, that's an insult, and I say fuck you.
Interesting.
No, I think it's a compliment. I think, do you feel like Cyclops is reflecting you, is becoming you, or you're becoming him?
Don't compare me to Cyclops.
Maybe he then goes
I'm
5 years
more. I'm not the shitty leader of this team.
Well,
a lot of questions there. The thing is, like, if Cyclops and Beast, who are both transported to the future, I wish they were like a little mini team. I want to have scenes with them being like, this is crazy, right? So that we can have a couple characters to get behind. So, like, that's a huge possibility for them. Maybe Psylocke's so sad is because she can't bring about the sum totality of her psychic powers and her psychic blade. Seems like something that she cares about based on everything she's ever said. I like Wolverine as the villain, actually, as the weapon, his greatest fear. We get to see him a couple times being just absolutely used here, but I do think there's something where he doesn't seem like he's being mind-controlled. So I'm curious what we're going to learn about him.
Next up is Binary Number One, written by Stephanie Phillips, art by Giada Belviso. The little twist here is this is Captain Marvel, who now has the Phoenix Force. She is protecting one small town of humans in what is clearly, I think, a COVID metaphor going on here in terms of them saying the virus is over, just let us out of this town, it's fine, don't worry about it. So in terms of that, that feels very of the moment and world outside your window sci-fi. It plays a little bit like an Outer Limits Twilight Zone type deal. So I like those parts of the issue. The one part I didn't like is there is a villain reveal, which is not 100% clear, I think.
Well, and I wanted to ask about that. She like takes her hood down and is like, it's me. And I was like, is it Scarlet Witch?
Is it Jean Grey? There's many redheads. It's probably Jean Grey. But I was also
based on the powers, though, that she uses in earlier on, it feels very Scarlet Witchy.
Yeah. It's just a redhead.
It's a red energy.
Right. I don't know.
It feels very strange, especially this crossover feels like it's fine bringing in characters. It's not just X-Men. It could be anybody. So we don't know. It could be Madeline Pryor.
Mm-hmm. Mary Jane. Could be Mary Jane.
Oh, man. She's Venom.
Great call. Not in this timeline, I would imagine. But this comic, I was like, interesting, but a weird one. Weird idea. I like the mystery of, like, Jean Grey's gone and the Phoenix has moved on. So there's definitely a story to tell there. So I like that gap. I want to follow the story into that gap and find out what happened to her.
Yeah, some really kind of cool panels of Phoenix.
Okay, there we go. I hear what you're not saying. Laura Kinney, Sabretooth, number one from Marvel. They're all from Marvel. Written by Jerrica Schultz, art by Valentina Pinti. This is following per the title Laura Kinney, who is now Sabretooth. She's got a kid, and she wants to give away that kid to not Dokken. They now call him Aki and Gabby. And send him off planet to Arako. And it seems like if Arako's Arakan, don't come and knock it.
Everyone's mad about Arako.
Yeah, they don't like Arako.
This was one of my favorites of this mini stack here. Like, I really like this. This felt the most like Age of Apocalypse, where we're getting to actually follow these characters on an emotional story. They're on opposite sides, but they're still able to maintain their familial connections. These are characters that we know, and it was great to see how they are used in this new space. So I thought this is really working. I like that we get to hear why Laura has chosen to be on the side of Revelation, which is what this story needs, so that we can understand the split here that's happening.
I respectfully disagree. I can understand why you like those things, but I was like, hey, you know how X-23 is awesome? I'm like, yeah, I love X-23. Well, guess what? X-23 is Sabretooth now. I was like, well, why would that happen? That seems like a horrible thing to have happened. It's like, yeah, the future is rough. People are giving kids away, and you got to worry about them. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
I would push back on you, Pete, and say there's story there. She seems like she fell in love with Sabretooth's son, who then they had a kid together, and he died. So there's a lot of story there that I think is going to be interesting, and we're going to find out about that.
I hear you, but I also can react to one of my favorite characters wearing a uniform that is a slap in the face. You know what I mean?
You don't like her clothes.
How dare you? That is not what I'm talking about.
You think she should dress prettier, or what are you saying?
Oh, that is horrible. Those things are horrible.
I mean, that's what you're saying. That is what you are saying.
Nope.
Here's the thing. She's wearing classic brown and yellow. That is Sabretooth, technically, but Wolverine also rocked those colors.
Well, yeah, I like this costume. I think this is a well-designed costume. Let's move on and talk about Long Shots, number one, written by Jonathan Hickman and Jerry Duggan, art by Alan Robinson. And this was my favorite issue of the mini stack, much to everybody's shock.
This comic was baffling to me. This is like a parody of the event.
100%.
You have to let the event start before you start making fun of it.
So Justin, how dare you? You get a shout out in this comic. Line producers, come on, JT. Yes, so this is your issue.
I knew you were going to bring
this. So this is focusing on Mojo realizes that nobody's watching any of his programs because the world has gone to shit because of Revelation. So he comes up with a new idea, which is create a bounty hunter show led by Hellcat and a ragtag team of folks. And he comes up with this working with the ex-babies who are all on his staff in different positions, including line producer. This 100% feels like whatever's going on in the event, Jonathan Hickman and Jerry Duggan wanted to do a thing, and they just did the thing. And it's, I thought, very funny, like just nonstop, ridiculous Hollywood jokes. Absolutely. I agree with you. You are right in theory that there is no reason that a parody of this event should be coming out of the first week of this event.
But wait 1 week with this one, guys.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I love this. Great art, great writing. Give me more. Injected in my veins. All the jokes with Longshot being like, I'm not involved in this, right? Very funny.
It's funny. Well, my favorite joke, and I feel like you might have enjoyed this as well, is when they cut to Craven, who has cut up all of the different Jeff the Land Sharks, which I was like, this is going to scare some kids. But it was funny.
All the different ways of spelling Jeff, and then he snorts the rhino's horn. And there's a running joke of being like, God, to the rhino, like, God, did you find your horn? That's so sad. It got stolen. The whole thing's insane. It's great.
Yeah.
So shouts to it, but very strange.
Do you think, you know, maybe Jerry and Hickman were just kind of like, man, line producer bit is so funny. We got to use that in our comic somehow.
Probably.
Yeah, they definitely ripped us off.
And last, but maybe least, maybe not least, I guess we'll find out. World of Revelation, number one, written by Al Ewing, Steve Fox, and Ryan North. Art by Augustine Alessio, Jesus Marino, and Adam Szaslowski. This is an anthology series giving us three different tales from throughout the Age of Revelation, every issue. What I was really shocked by this one was the art style. I didn't love every story, but particularly the first one, like the coded really issue, cool. It was just like beautifully painted story and beautifully laid out. I thought the second story was the one with Apocalypse and a mysterious person who shows up, which I also thought was...
No, that was the first, the end of the first story.
Oh, right. That was great.
The second story was the Hulkling story, which was deeply upsetting. This was my favorite issue of the bunch. Because I think this does the best job of being like, this is a world, here's how people are living in this world. The first story is like a history of Araco underneath this, with a great reveal at the end that I will spoil by saying it's Professor X coming to talk to Apocalypse. I was like, this feels like the story.
You like
this
that? Feels like you like the I fact did. That he was walking and...
I love the idea that they're
look
like
a kind of brother and not really him.
What?
It didn't look like him. It looked like maybe his brother or something. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's 10 years Juggernaut? Later, so he's a little chunkier. It's all right.
So he's gained a little weight. Get off Professor X jog.
I just like, is that him? Are we supposed to think that that's him?
Do you think he's getting some Ozempic from Apocalypse?
I don't know, but that last panel really kind of turned me off where it was like, hey, the Age of Heroes is over. I was like, okay, well, bye. Thanks for nothing, I guess.
No, but like there, what I liked about that,
I root for heroes to win. I don't root for other things to happen. What the fuck am I supposed to read this
first
for?
Of all, the thing about Apocalypse being like, I should have chosen Richter, like undercutting everything.
That was, I thought, a great joke.
Great
a very
joke,
weird
great
joke.
Joke at the end there. And it really did that moment. Again, who knows what the story of this thing going to be? But Professor X and Apocalypse in that moment, it feels like, all right, kids have had their time to play. Now daddy's home. And I like that. It was really good.
Honestly, of everything we've read so far, this felt like the center of the story. These two being like, hey, we sort of messed up with letting Revelation run shit. Because, you know, Professor X chose him back in Krakoa to be like his guy. So they've both messed up. Like, they have to go get him. I'm like, this is cool. I like this.
I was like, I don't know who standing Professor X is.
It's Professor X, whether he has a lollipop head or has gained a little weight, it's still him.
Legs guy. I don't know who this legs guy is.
I got a haircut today. Am I still me, Pete?
I don't know. We haven't seen you with the hat off, by the way.
I also really like the Wiccan Hulkling story.
I got my hair cut to look like a hat.
You got hat hair.
Well, then great job, man. It looks like a hat.
Thanks.
The Wiccan Hulkling story I thought was really good, very tragic, really putting this power that Revelation has of taking away people's language on Front Street in a way that like I thought was excellent. And then the last story, focusing by Ryan North, focusing on Franklin Richards in a super sideways story, was just like a cool, weird story to have here. This was the best package.
And that is it for this week's Age of Revelation. So why don't we move on?
Let's keep it going next week, I say.
Yeah, we'll, at the very least, I think, try these out for the first week, see where we're going. If we want,
I'm sticking with it, Alex.
Well, we'll see if we want to continue with all of them or whittle them down a little bit or what's going on. All right, calm down. We're still, for an entire month, we're going to do all of them. Court, Children of the Round Table, number 2 from DC Comics,
really
written by Tom Taylor, art by Daniel DiNicolo. This is a new all-ages series about a bunch of kids who find weapons that are imbued with the spirits of the Knights of the Round Table. And now there are some bad guys coming for them in this issue. Pete, how are you feeling 2 issues in?
I love this. I know this is, it has a feeling of kind of all ages with the art, but I love the art style. It brings like a cool lightness to it. I love the vibe. But this is fun. This is just a great story, fun adventure story with a bunch of kids. You got a badass grandma.
There it is.
Cool secret tunnel. Come on, dude. This is great.
I was waiting for it the entire time. I knew it.
As soon as I read this, I was like, Pete is literally loving this.
Yes.
He's just...
Come on.
Sexually charged. Put it in the bank.
Stop that.
Yeah, she was a total giller, right? Grandma, I'd like to read.
What?
I don't know. I was trying to think of something non-sexual about Pete's obsession with badass grandpas.
Grandma, grandpa, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, this is a fun book. I'm really enjoying
it. Is that when you say nanners, are you talking about nanas? Is that what that means?
No.
Super tight nanas?
I'm talking about bananas.
Are you sure?
And when you're talking about super tight nanas, what part of them is tight?
Yeah, what are you talking about?
What are you referring to?
How great the art is. It's super tight nanners, man. It's so good.
Interesting.
Okay, I'm going to hear that differently.
Great. Yeah. Well, check out this all-ages series we just ruined. Next up.
I do enjoy this book. This book is very smartly written and paced. This is a great, fun story. You don't have to worry about any continuity. You can just come in. The characters are interesting and fun. I like the Arthurian underpinning to it all. It's doing very well, I think.
Marion Heretic, number 1 from Boom Studios, written by Teenie Howard, art by Jose Jaro.
Teenie!
This is a nunsploitation comic book.
Hey, nunsploitation, that's fun.
Yeah, I didn't make it up. That's in the synopsis. That's what they call it. And it is about a nun who was part of an alternate coven, I guess you could call it, where they worshipped Mary instead of the dude gods. they got taken down by the regular church. She essentially got enslaved by them and now needs to fight and kill witches for them. But by the end of the issue, there's been a bit of a change in her status quo. I think this really delivered on the premise, explored it in interesting and surprising ways, and had some really nice art to match that leans into a little bit cartoony, but keeps the action clear and the characters clear throughout. This is, given the nunsploitation thing, like, it's bloody. There's a little bit of titillation going on here, but it keeps it all in service of the story, which I thought was nice to see.
I agree. I love this. I thought the art was excellent, and the story was really compelling. It, you know, you're on a journey with it, and then it lands it in such a great place. There's like a bit of a relationship, I think, happening with the characters who are facing off at the end. I thought this was excellent.
Yeah, I mean, the sexualization of the nun and the witch were a little over the top for me. But other than that, I was having a great time and I thought it was interesting and cool. But I was like, what? The hot nun is going to team up with the hot witch? Oh, you don't say. But
yeah, you wish they were 30 to 40 years older. I get you.
No, I just, you know, I was like, you know, it can just be regular. It doesn't have to be like overly sexualized. No, but that's the thing.
Like, they're playing with genre here. They very specifically call it, I know I've said this three times already, but nunsploitation.
Nunsploitation. Yeah.
That's what they're reading into. And I think what works about it is it's playing into that B, C, D movie level thing, but being smarter about it and trying to explore what it'll actually mean by giving it a little more space for the characters to grow.
Okay.
All right.
Got him.
Ha ha. Super Creep Show special number one from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Dan Waters, Ryan Stegman and Ed Bryson, art by Carmine D. Giandomenico, Riley Rosmo, and Andre Bresson. You can probably figure this out by the title, but this is a Creep Show anthology giving us three short horror tales, but through the lens of superhero comics. What did you guys think about this?
I like this. I want to shout out the Riley Rosmo art and the Ed Bryson, Andre Bresson, the Bryson to Bresson combo in the third story. I thought was really.
Do you think they got paired because of their last names? Because I kind of think so.
Sounds like a typo, but it really worked.
I agree. This was a blast, a fun collection of kind of creepy tales. Love the art. You know, the Creep Show kind of narrator has a fun common thread. I thought all these ideas were well executed. Grave Ghost was cool.
May I say, cool cover. Moving on, Godzilla number three. It's a parody of the Dark Knight Returns cover with the lightning, there but the creep is jumping across instead. Fun little riff there. Godzilla number three from IDW, written by Tim Seeley, art by Nicola Cismeggia. In this issue, like all of the others, we've got a ragtag team that is fighting some kaiju, but there are a lot of forces aligned against them. And this issue, they go under the sea.
Oh, you asshole. Nah. Don't ruin this for me, man. This is fun. All right.
Ruin it for you. The Little Mermaid is one of my favorite movies of all time. That's a compliment.
Doesn't seem like it with your tone, asshole. Anyways, this was really fun. I love the art style. There's like a cool vibe to it. Fun action. I love the joke on the kind of Kelso coin. I just had an absolute blast with this. Don't fuck with Godzilla. This is great.
Yes, Pete is finally in the bag for a Godzilla comic. I love that they go under the sea.
And Tim Seeley continues to be an incredible writer.
And last but not least, Everything Dead and Dying, number two from Image Comics, written by Tate Bromble, art by Jacob Phillips. This takes place in a very different zombie world where, at least in the location that this one guy is living in, the zombies don't seem to actually eat people. Instead, he is delusionally living with the still shambling dead bodies of his family and neighbors and friends. And into this not so idyllic paradise comes a group of people that are very grossed out about it and want to kill everybody around him. And he doesn't take well to that.
Yeah, I think this comic is excellent. I love this issue. The structure of it, where we're flashing between So the relationships between the characters, the two fathers, the child that they brought into their lives, and their like relationship struggles around that, how they're dealing with it, are great flashbacks in between our main character dealing with the fact that, yes, they're zombified versions of themselves. And these townspeople are like, we kill zombies here, right? And he's like, no, this is my family. Like, there's a great metaphor underneath this, I think.
The art is excellent. One man's trash is another man's treasure.
Not the one I was going for, but that's okay. Nice, I guess, in a very succinct way.
One man's
way of
family
talking about
is another man's nightmare? Is that better?
Yeah, I guess in a way.
Okay.
Really, really boiled
as
down.
As long as it's crocheted on something I can put on my wall, I honestly do not care.
And Alex, every piece of art on Alex's wall is crocheted.
Alex, don't forget to live.
What is
love,
that
laugh.
Actually called? That's not crocheted. What is that? Needlepoint?
Cross-stitch.
Cross-stitch? Yes. Okay.
That's maybe needlepoint is right.
Yeah. We're very crafty.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an...
I mean, it's okay for us to not know. That's, you know who knows that? The women that Pete wants to date.
What? Wait, what? What kind of shots fired was that?
Killers.
What are you trying to say?
Killers, if you ask me.
You're deep into the needlepoint culture when it comes to the dating apps.
Right? I realize I'm yelling this like a crazy person, but I'm a catch, damn it.
I'm not saying you're not a catch. No. I'm just saying you're looking to meet someone who is, you know, close to retiring.
That's not true at all.
Oh, is retiring.
Okay.
Don't put stuff out there like that. Anyways, I think this is an
more time to hang out.
Yeah, Pete's Tinder profile. His sub headline is "I'm a Werther's original."
It's not a bad bit. I should use that.
That's good. Let's workshop your app, your profile, right?
Oh,
is that a good use of our time?
Definitely do. That's,
make
that's
a real grandma trap in there.
Anyway, back to Everything Dead and Dying, which is the name of Pete's
Tinder profile.
Yeah, I do think that this is an interesting idea and well executed here, and this is some great art.
It really is. And that is it for The Stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to talk to you about comics, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, first off, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
First off, Pete's going to be at bingo tonight, and he is ready to hang.
Join Alex, Justin, and Tony from every Tuesday night, once a week, they'll blow your mind with their comic senses. And extend their already extended adolescence. At a comic book club, comic book club.
Hear that? That's the sound of 10 quintillion bugs on this planet, and they're trying to make your home, home. With the Greenix Pest Control Plan, you don't have to worry. Ah, much better. If it creeps, crawls, bites, or stings, Greenix has you covered. Visit GoGreenix.com today to save $150 on pest control. That's GoGreenix.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.